We'll call the meeting to order and continue with the Department of Administration. We understand that Commissioner is not here, but
that's right.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Sheila Rieger, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. Our Commissioner Dana Badgerow is out of the office today, so I'm covering for her a bit. We have a couple of other staff here from admin to go over really the final five change items and to answer any questions you have. We also will take just a couple minutes to review two of the capital bonding items that are in your packets. We'll start off with the first two pieces. I have two staff here from the Materials Management Division who will introduce themselves, and we'll just get right into it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Dorothy Lovejoy. I'm in the Materials Management Division of the Department of Administration. I am here to talk about our request for $850,000 to conduct a statistically balanced study that's needed in order to maintain Minnesota's affirmative action purchasing program. This program was created by the legislature in 1990 and gives purchasing preferences to certain Minnesota small businesses. The purchasing preference is generally 6%. As an example, if I were out taking bids for this bottle of water and a non-targeted vendor bid $100, a targeted business could bid $1.02 or 3 cents or $1.06 and still be awarded that as the low bid. And that's the purchasing preference we're talking about today. Businesses that are eligible for the program, some are based on location in economically disadvantaged counties in the state, but others are eligible based on the characteristics of the business owner. And that might be women, minorities, or persons with substantial physical disabilities. There is also a bill making its way through the legislature this session that would add veteran-owned small businesses to those that are eligible for purchasing preferences.
Yes.
The federal courts have dictated what we have to do in order to award preferences on the basis of race and gender. For preferences on economic disadvantage, such as those low-income counties or labor surplus areas, we only need a rational basis to do that. But the courts have said it is inherently suspect to award preferences on the basis of race and gender. The distinction makes sense when you realize the case law came from protecting those very groups during the civil rights and equal rights era. The courts apply strict scrutiny tests if there is preference on the basis of race and an intermediate scrutiny test for preference on the basis of gender. The interpretation for settlement is that we must have a compelling interest to treat people differently on the basis of race and gender. We must have a statistical data of past discrimination before we can apply preferences as a remedy. Specifically, analysis to determine if purchases from minority and female-owned businesses are statistically proportionate to their representation in the marketplace. The last study we conducted was in 1999, and it was based on data from fiscal years 96 and 97. That study resulted in a matrix of eligibility that I know you can't see from here that showed that certain groups of businesses were eligible for preferential treatment across all areas of purchasing, while other groups were eligible in only some categories of purchasing. In May of 2006, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights issued this document, Disparity Studies as Evidence of Discrimination in Federal Contracting. And despite its title, there are 16 of the 31 recommendations in this document are recommendations to states and local governments. The key recommendation number one, states and localities must discard disparity studies conducted using data that is more than 5 years old. The results are too outdated to justify preferential awards given today. Researchers must use current data. Our data is already 10 to 11 years old, and by the time we can complete another study if funded, it will be 12 to 13 years old. So you're probably wondering, why did we wait so long? It's the cost. It's extremely expensive to conduct these studies. Our study in 1999 was at a price of $500,000. and that was only the consultant costs and did not include the project management costs. In 99, the Commonwealth of Virginia studied other states' studies and concluded that their cost to conduct such a study would be $950,000. In 2004, we contacted the consultants that did our previous study and asked for an informal, what would it take to do the same level of study today? They told us then it would be at least $750,000 in consulting costs alone. The process to reach the legally and statistically defensible outcome is extremely complex. The last time we did this study, the consultants analyzed nearly 600,000 state contracts, and that included metropolitan government contracts as well. And again, going back to this document, and I have copies available if anyone is interested. The Commission on Civil Rights has said we have to throw out the studies that are more than 5 years old. This program has been a good incubator of developing small businesses in Minnesota. In the budget narrative, there's two businesses that I'm very personally familiar with that have grown up through the program and started out very small. One is now in the top 10 Asian-owned businesses in the country. Another started out with one employee, just himself, doing network cabling. He now has 54 employees and does a lot of the work in the Capitol Complex area. This study will also be used by Pollution Control Agency and other Minnesota agencies to address federal requirements that's tied to their receipt of federal grant dollars. Pollution Control estimated $134 million is at risk this biennium if we do not complete the new disparity study. The federal requirements are not my area of expertise. We were hoping to have a couple of people from Pollution Control Agency here today to address that. They had a conflict with another hearing at the same time. I'm sure they would be available if the committee has any other questions.
Okay.
And I would be happy to take any questions.
Representative Fox. Thank you, Madam Chair. You just mentioned that one of the departments is has a loss cost. Your most recent statement where you were talking about how this disparity study is maybe impacting them negatively. So I'm just wondering, or the older disparity study, do you have a total cost of how much the agencies are at risk of losing and how much to kind of do more of a cost ratio on the benefit of it?
Madam Chair, Representative, Pollution Control Agency has told us they're at risk of losing $134 million in federal funds.
Any other questions about this? Okay, maybe you said this and I missed it. The price for that, is this a contract that's put out on that $850,000 price?
Yes, we would put that out on a request for proposals.
Okay, and where did the fact that it will cost that much come from?
Madam Chair,
with no knowledge, it just seems like a lot.
Madam Chair, our last study was $500,000 in consulting costs. And in 1999, the Commonwealth of Virginia studied several other states' studies and concluded their own cost to conduct such a study would be $950,000. And we asked our previous consultants for an informal quote in 2004. And they told us at that time $750,000 in consulting costs.
Okay. At some point, you think we would have had better ongoing data after all those years, you know, considering all the information we're collecting about all sorts of things. I don't know. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, quorum being present, Representative Flesch moves the minutes of the previous meeting.
Indeed I do, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay.
and no. Okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betsy Hayes, and I am a manager in the Materials Management Division of the Department of Administration, and I'm very happy to be here today. I think I'm here to tell you about a tremendous opportunity that we have at the state. What we are requesting is funding for three temporary positions charged with reducing the cost of state consulting contracts. This would allow the expansion of some exciting work that we've been doing in our division. Many of you may recall not too long ago at the Governor's State of the State address, there was a standing ovation given by the audience to a colleague of mine, Brenda Willard, in the Materials Management Division for her work and many others in the area of strategic sourcing and the costs that that initiative had saved the state. And one of the elements of strategic sourcing is and one component, and one thing in the toolbox, is that of placing a much greater emphasis on negotiations. We have had a very good success record so far in the area of goods and non-professional technical services. We've been tracking our success in this area since the beginning of fiscal year 2006, where we've specifically focused on tracking negotiated savings. And so far, from that point to date, we have tracked $11.8 million in price reductions, and that is beyond the price offered by the winning vendor in a competitive procurement process. And that price, interestingly enough, that $11.8 million is up from the $9.4 million that you see in your budget documents. So even in this short period of time between the time the budget document was created and the present time, we have been able to achieve another $2.4 million. Which interestingly exceeds our division's annual general fund appropriation per year. These successful savings and negotiations have occurred in the areas of buying chairs, hardware and software purchases, hazardous waste management contracts, and convention facilities contracts. And what we're trying to do is expand that success that we've seen in the area of goods and non-professional services over to the professional technical services area. And this does involve some interesting challenges. First of all, as many of you may know, the professional technical area of the statutory scheme is decentralized. So agencies are doing their own solicitations, they are doing their own evaluations and negotiating their own contracts. And the role of the Department of Administration in this area has been to focus on that of compliance and making sure that they're in compliance with state mandates, but not involved directly in the evaluation process and specifically not involved in their negotiation process. In fiscal year 2006, the state awarded consulting contracts totaling $364 million. And I really think, and we believe in our division, that this is a tremendously wonderful opportunity to reduce that cost with some administrative support to those agencies. And this is what this budget request would fund. We are doing some work as best we can with the resources we have in this area. We have already used the Commissioner of Administration's authority to require serious consideration of price when evaluating professional technical contracts. Currently, state law requires that price has to be a factor when you are evaluating an RFP. But the statute doesn't say how much weight you have to put in the RFP, and traditionally agencies had put 5% or 10% that we saw come through waiting on price. And so in August of 2005, the commissioner issued a policy that required that agencies weight price at 30% and in some cases 40% if a shortlist had been done. And what this resulted in was it required the winning vendor to be much more competitive on price. And to test the effectiveness of this new policy, we analyzed 104 pre-policy contracts and found through an analysis that had we been using the 30 or 40% weighting, that 19 of those contracts would have actually been awarded to different vendors at a savings of almost $2.6 million. And that's an 11% savings on those 104 contracts that we analyzed. Also what we have done on negotiations, since at the same time the price policy came out, we have really tried to focus with agencies to encourage negotiations, and we are tracking what their successes are. And so far, we've seen some success, but we know that they need help. So far, the agencies have reported $770,329 in negotiated savings on 26 different contracts. But this is the tip of the iceberg. Agencies did 1,652 contracts and 973 amendments in fiscal year 06. So there is a lot of contracts where there are good opportunities for negotiation. So the question, what would admin bring to the table with this money? What we would bring is, first of all, education. I've been surprised over my time to talk to agency representatives and to learn that they think that they're not allowed to negotiate consulting contracts. They believe that they have to go with the price that was offered by the proposer. Another issue that we have to face is that because of the decentralized nature, there are many employees out there who only do professional technical contracts maybe once or twice or a few times in their career. They are not there to be skilled. They are not skilled negotiators. And, in fact, there's no reason to expect that they would be. They were hired for their expertise in their program area and not as skilled negotiators. Agencies also indicate that they either fear the negotiation process, they may find it intimidating, or they fear damage to a long-term relationship that they'll have to engage in after the contract. So based on what we've learned, we really think that a partnership with the agencies is the way to go. The agency brings the technical expertise regarding the contract to the table, and admin can bring the negotiation skills and even the willingness to be the bad cop if that strategic decision is made to engage in those types of negotiations. An example where we have succeeded in the past, we partnered with the Department of Finance and and the Office of Enterprise Technology on the MAPS upgrade consulting contract. And in that particular case, we're able to negotiate the price down $113,000 without a reduction in scope. And then once that negotiation was done, the admin negotiator was able to step away and the other parties were able to continue on with their relationship with the vendor. Other strategies and techniques that we feel we would use this money towards is additional training on topics where we've seen either bid protests, proposal protests, or litigation, things like conflicts of interest, evaluation methods. We would be able to enhance our training in those areas. We also are very excited about consolidating redundant contracts where we can take an enterprise approach, develop enterprise contracts in the PT area so agencies aren't doing it in siloed fashion. And then we also, and we believe that those opportunities would be seen in things like occupational health contracts, IT-related services, and so on. We believe this initiative will more than pay for itself. We're not asking for a base increase, but for a one-time money. And then once that is complete, if that happens, our challenge will then be to work with the Department of Finance to create a mechanism to use the savings to fund these positions so that they can remain beyond this biennium. So with that, I'm happy to take your questions.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to ask such a rudimentary question. What does PT stand for and what does MAPS stand for?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry that I use acronyms so freely. I think that's something about state government that lots of people. PT stands
for... We're grateful to people who ask, though.
Yes. The PT stands for Professional Technical, and that is what we use when we refer to consulting-type contracts that are intellectual in nature. Things like studies, like a disparity study, would be a professional technical contract or other things of that nature. And then MAPS is the Minnesota Accounting and Procurement System, and that is the statewide accounting and procurement system.
A follow-up?
Yes.
On these professional technical contracts, are these items that existing state employees can't do? One thing that surprised me as a new member of the legislature is how much money we spend on consultants. It makes you wonder if we have any state employees. We spend so much on consulting.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is an issue that's frequently asked about and talked about. And, in fact, the legislature passed many years ago a requirement in law that before you can enter into a professional technical contract, you have to certify to the Commissioner of Administration that there are no state employees able and available to perform the work. So that is something that agencies, for each and every contract over $5,000 or potential contract, they have to explain in their documents as part of the procedure what they've done and to assure that there are no state employees able to do the work.
Are those documents available to the public to review?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they are. They are public data.
Thank you.
And I think the obvious question, too, is do they just have to make a pro forma statement, or do they actually, for example, do they have to show that they put out on the state, is there any requirement to put out on the department website, for example, a brief description of a job with a request for employees able to perform, for state employees and other departments perhaps able to do that? Is there any requirement for that?
Madam Chair, many years ago there was a requirement that they post upcoming positions in the HR offices around the state, and that was subsequently repealed. Another provision along that line.
It's not the same thing, though. We're asking about PT services.
Right. Madam Chair, several years ago, and I can't tell you how many,
okay.
There was a requirement that if you were going to put out an RFP for a consultant, that you had to post a notice of that opportunity in the HR office around the government. And I don't know when that was repealed, but there was also another provision in law that was also repealed later that required the creation of an employee skills inventory where people would be able to match. But again, that was later repealed. So right now, the process that we have, our agencies need to write, they have to, number one, certify, and they have to write a statement as to how they made that determination.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
At this point, we'll go on to the next slide, which is the SMART,
okay.
And a small agency resource team. I'll refer to it as SMART, if I may, going forward. This is a new initiative. It's really something that's brought forth as a practical.
Could you please give your name for the tape? You don't even.
Once again, I'm Sheila Rieger, Deputy Commissioner. Thank you. Of Administration. So
the
SMART.
Someone doesn't see it's the same person, so each time you come again, you can say it. Thanks.
So today, three things I'd like to leave you with today about the SMART initiative. One is how the idea arose, what it really is, and why we think it's a good idea for state government. Just some background. Currently, you may know or may not know that admin provides a range of HR services for not only admin employees, but also the Office of Enterprise Technology. We provide HR and financial services to 5 councils and boards as well. Some examples of the services that we provide to these groups are vacancy filling and classification, benefits administration, new employee orientation, and then payroll, accounts payable, and purchasing. So the customers that we have, we create relationships with them. They trust us. They come to us for immediate needs. We're able to prioritize among them and deliver good services. We have a seasoned group of professionals, both in the financial and in the HR human resources field, and we do a really good job. As a result, I think of that, we were approached a few months back, actually from Doer. And they asked us to consider expanding that HR service to provide that to a wider group of the small agencies, the boards and councils, who are currently coming to Doer for that kind of support. They come to Doer for vacancy filling and for classification support. Doer has been providing that over the years, even though it's not really part of their core mission. So Doer asked us to think about whether or not we could expand. At about the same time, the Department of Finance came to us and asked us if we would consider providing financial services to some of those same small boards and agencies that come to them for support. So we were kicking this idea around and how we might expand. Of course, the staff that we have right now, we have 11 HR professionals, who are pretty much at maximum right now, particularly given OET and the changing environment in that agency. We knew we could provide the services, but we just didn't have enough resources to do that. Right about that time, we were asked to put together an initiative, a change item, to request some funding to actually initiate that. It's my understanding that some of those small boards and agencies had come forward with change items of their own, asking for additional resources. In past budget years, they had been receiving cuts and were experiencing a hardship just with their daily operations. So I believe finance, instead of trying to figure out how to spread those sorts of resources around, decided to put them in one center where these small boards could come for support. I'm talking primarily about human resources services, but we do similar functions, as I said, in the financial area. So we created this initiative, and actually the goal of the SMART, the Small Agency Resource Team, would be to provide these services from a central location. It asks for funding for 2.5 full-time equivalent FTEs, employees, and then also phones, some rent, and some computer support. Putting these resources together within admin ensures that we have experienced staff who are knowledgeable about the state HR and financial systems that will provide the service. It recognizes that it's difficult for a small board, as an example, to afford to have that kind of expertise on staff. Some of the boards have six people. To have somebody that is that knowledgeable in those areas is difficult. So admin would agree to perform this work and put together a service level agreement with those boards and councils that would set turnaround times and make clear the services that we would provide, the time frames, the parameters around those services. So finally, why this is a good idea, we think that there are real benefits to a team approach. Right now, if there's a small agency, let's say of even 20 people, and they have one part-time office manager that's providing HR and financial resources, if that person goes on vacation or if that person takes another position, that agency is left without that kind of support. This would be a team approach, provides backup, provides the ability to share expertise among the team. We would set common processes. For example, right now we have different boards and councils that have different procedures, different policies, different affirmative action plans. We would put together some templates, some common processes that would make things more smoothly operating. We would make sure that we put solid HR policies in place. The staff that we have a range of expertise to draw from, and they're able to address a wide range of issues as opposed to someone in one small agency that would have a limited scope of experience. You may have, over the past many years, come to know that some of the small boards and agencies have experienced problems with their financial audits, questionable financial transactions. Purchasing and contracting is a difficult process for them to follow. There have been HR lawsuits, and we believe if we can provide services to those smaller groups, we can help avoid that, or at a minimum, be there to respond quickly should issues arise. So the SMART team would be in a position to provide professional consultation to these groups and help them avoid the issues. Now, since the time that change item was submitted, you may have come to be aware that there is a doer reorganization. So I thought I would just take a minute to address that and how that would affect this initiative. I think it's important to note that DOER is proposing to move 5 employees over to the Department of Administration. These would be human resource employees who would also bring along the work that they are currently doing for, I believe it's 40 to 45 small agencies and boards. They're proposing combining them with the SMART team, which makes a lot of sense. But I wanted just to be clear that the services that they'll provide are not in addition to what they're already doing. Right now, a small board or agency has a vacancy. They go to DOER and they get some level of transactional support. So that work comes along with them.
Okay, I have a couple of questions about this. One, I think that this is a really good idea, and I really think looking at the impact of not funding. But when we fund it, it seems to me we ought to be seeing savings somewhere. You know, and I don't know how we get to, and I think people putting together the total state budget would like to see those savings somewhere. I don't know how we can see them. I also have one, looking at your name, I just realized that if you called it the Tiny Agency Resource Team, it could then be TART, which would be save you a whole letter, and it would also be a more obvious acronym.
Madam Chair, we'll consider that. if I may, as far as the savings, we too would like to see savings. In fact, part of the Drive to Excellence initiative, we all have in mind ways to quantify savings in a variety of ways. This initiative is a good one. What we don't want to do is start out shorting ourselves so that we can't do a good job. But frankly, I believe that as a team, once we get those processes and procedures in place, we will be more efficient. I truly believe that. My sense is that we would begin to use those extra resources to provide more support. But at some point, I think we would be able to do more with fewer people.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Commissioner, I don't know if the answer is good enough. I'd like to follow through on what Chairman Khan is talking about. You know, we hear often about if we spend so much more money, we're going to save all this additional money. If we spend a dollar here, we're going to save three, we're going to save seven. And sometime or another, I want to see the savings. And, as I look at your sheet here, and I, the SMART acronym is fine with me. I don't see any problem there. But, you know, when you look, it looks at the impact of not funding, it says inefficiency, meaning that we're going to become more efficient. But to become more efficient, it's going to cost us 2.5 full-time equivalents of $500,000. We have to be able to justify that, so we have to be able to say, well, if we're going to become more efficient, which costs, I thought we'd save money by becoming more efficient. You know, I'm kind of a little farm boy, you know, thinking that if you become more efficient, you're actually saving money. No. But you're going to cost us money with the initiative, 2.5 full-time equivalents, become more efficient, and we don't see the savings. I need to see the savings.
Madam Chair, Representative, agreed. There is no good argument to that, clearly. I think one thing that's important to note, the efficiency that would be gained is really for the small boards and councils. We have, as I said, we'll just take one example of, let's say, a 20-person board. They're spending a percentage of their time trying to provide administrative resources, and they're struggling with that. So they get themselves in trouble. They come to Doer. They go to finance. They spend time fixing and working, trying to figure out contracting. If they have a place to go on a routine basis where there is support, there are people who know their needs, we think that added efficiency would be gained within that small board and council. That's difficult to quantify, I understand.
Okay. Well, we'll search together, Representative, for that. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment about the SMART. I was just at another committee meeting, and we heard from the Boxing Commission, and it sounds as though they would benefit from having the opportunity to be able to work with somebody as the Scott Ledoux, who is now the Boxing Executive Director, a part-time position, is working out of his home, is developing his own letterhead, is making copies on his own, doing some things that I do think that there probably should be a little bit more oversight as well in as you're having a commission or some other smaller board doing some things that maybe it would help. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go on.
Okay.
We are trying to cram you into half a meeting, so I hope that
thank you. Work with that.
My name is Lenore Madigan with the Department of Administration, and I'm just going to very briefly address the compensation adjustment. During the budget preparation, all agencies were directed to plan for 3.25% increases in salaries per year and benefits. This request for $525,000 is the governor's recommendation for 2% for administration's general fund activities. In the Department of Administration, we look closely at how we should be utilizing this funding, and we have directed, as you'll see in the budget documents, that we are looking to maintain construction management services and real estate services. So the majority of the funds that we have requested in this change item of $525,000 will be directed towards those two activities. And that is what we're planning to do, is, and that will assist us in continuing to actively manage more than 450 construction projects and assist in relocation activities for the Real Estate Management Division.
Okay. Finally, our last change item is the Energy Conservation Recommissioning in your packet. We have Nikki Giancola here.
Good afternoon again. For the record, my name is Nikki Giancola, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Administration, and I'll follow up with our last change item here. It's our recommissioning initiative. This is a request of $500,000 over the biennium to fund the evaluation and repair of state building mechanical systems in an effort to reduce energy and to return systems to their peak efficiency. By executive order, state agencies are required now to demonstrate the benefits of energy conservation, and this would surely assist them in doing that. You can think of recommissioning as a tune-up for a building. It's a systematic process that's applied to existing buildings that helps you identify and solve mechanical system problems that are wasting energy and making your facility more expensive to operate. Building systems do change over time. They age, and energy and operating performance may suffer. You also may experience indoor air quality problems as a result. In addition, space usage changes over time, and people densities fluctuate, and the building systems may no longer support those changes in the building occupancy. And recommissioning, really, it's about giving you the opportunity to reevaluate your building and the systems against the original design intent, and it would help you optimize performance of your building as it ages and, again, as your occupancy changes. It also can be an opportunity to provide building operators with systems training refresher course. As buildings change over time, as you can imagine, the operators of buildings change as well. And that knowledge just doesn't travel from person to person. So at certain points in a building's life, this really does help you optimize and retrain a lot of things that, bottom line, will help you conserve energy and save money. Literally, this is an activity that pays for itself often within a year or two, and it's a prudent facility management activity, but it does take some upfront investment to accomplish it. So just to recap the benefits of recommissioning, it conserves energy resources by helping you identify and reduce energy waste. It helps you lower energy costs. It helps you pin down and fix existing problems. It improves indoor air quality and occupant comfort. It increases equipment life, and it reduces staff time spent on emergency calls. And in some cases, for instance, with Xcel Energy, rebates are available to help offset the cost of both the study and the implementation. This funding would allow admin to recommission approximately 20 to 25 buildings over the biennium. These studies cost an average of $20,000 to $25,000 apiece. It's very diagnostic laden, and this is the size of a recommissioning study, but it's full of energy conservation opportunities and measures that building operators can put into play, and many of them are low cost and no cost to do. The results of some of our prior recommissionings have shown an average of 5 to 15% energy consumption reduction by performing them. So that is recommissioning. Stand for any questions?
Well, I guess part of my question is, are you looking at all at the effect of directed light, specifically getting rid of outdoor light pollution for the outdoor parts of buildings?
Madam Chair, lighting is a big part of recommissioning. I think you would have to look at the building, its current use. As I stated earlier, not only building systems change, but the use of buildings change. And so if you had, for instance, a small office building that was built for that purpose years ago, and you provided outdoor lighting for safety. If that occupancy changed, you'd certainly want to take a look at exterior lighting and adjust it accordingly.
Any other questions? No? Okay.
I am prepared to quickly run through. At one point, committee administrator, something had asked for us to go through our capital bonding request. So if we have a few minutes, and I'll just quickly run through those. The first one is the repair of the exterior structural support system of the Department of Transportation building here on Capitol Complex. Some of you may know that, I mean, this is the fifth request that admin's made for this particular project. The structural support system that secures the granite panels on that building is failing due to its extensive rust, which is caused by exposure to moisture. The force of this corroding steel is powerful, and the rusting process is subjecting the 1,200-pound panels to compression, which is resulting in spalling. I do have a box of some of the spalled pieces that we have taken off. If any of you are interested, I could have somebody pass around that box. They're all labeled and marked. Jim, would you just... Seems like some people are interested. But it interferes with the integrity of those granite panels. We have both of... the horizontal and the vertical movements occurring on the panels on the building. In your packet and on the slides here, you can see evidence of some of what I'm talking about here. There's literally been measurable movement of many of the panels on the building. Bottom line is failure to act is going to result in increased spalling and an increased risk that a panel will fall. Our engineering consultants have stated that without a repair to the facade, a panel failure is inevitable. The design effort for this condition has been underway for several years, and just this past year we have lost our insurance coverage, specifically if a panel should fall. So we've lost the coverage for that piece of it. Up here on the screen, you can see the top shot is of a corroded shelf angle. There's a shelf angle, kind of an L shape, that each panel sits on, and as the rust pack increases, it's pushing those panels up. And you can see here the rusted shelf angle, and on the photo below, we've got four steel columns on the north stairway of the building that it has corroded to the point where you can actually, by hand, just chunk off some of that rust there. It has compromised the integrity of those columns, and we really do need to move on with this project. A couple more photos of a corroded shelf angle and the loose rust that... as we've done inspections on the building, we have uncovered these conditions. The cost continues to escalate. This request right now is $11.8 million. Again, I've mentioned that the risk is increasing, both the fact that a panel truly could fall. We've got spalling pieces. We've lost our insurance for that piece of the building. Prior years, as a safety precaution, we've installed fencing around the building that many of you may have noticed. What you may not have noticed is we've also installed what we call cribbing. It's plywood and foam board to try to absorb the spalls as they come down. But as we've discovered, that really doesn't even stop some of the spalled pieces. They have this tendency to bounce away from the cribbing, and so we've got increased risk that either some of those fall pieces could fall back into windows, or they could go the other way and go out onto the pedestrian walkways outside of the fencing. So, bottom line, no one is able to predict the timing or extent of a panel failure. However, as stated by our expert, without a repair, it's inevitable, and it's also a known condition. And I would just end with, I really do feel like this needs to be taken care of. So, and that again is why it is on the emergency bonding request of governors. The next project is
Hi. I haven't followed the history on the transportation building. Can you tell me, was this an anticipated deterioration or unanticipated?
Madam Chair and Representative, I would say it was clearly not anticipated. Between the years of, I think it was 92 and 98, the floors in the MnDOT building were renovated, and as part of that renovation, some exterior work was done for tuck pointing, and it was, I believe, in the final stages of that floor-by-floor renovation that it was discovered this rusting occurring on the structural support system. And it was at that point then that we started the design effort put together a project and started coming forward to the legislature with a repair of it. As time has gone on, during the winter months particularly, we've done monitoring and inspections of particular panels, particular sites that the consultants felt were more at risk, and the condition just, it doesn't end. So, again, I would say not anticipated, but clearly we've taken it seriously and done the monitoring and put together a design effort so that once the money is appropriated, we're ready to go.
Representative Anderson, you might, this is not the first time this has appeared as a repair request.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions? Just so I can get up to speed with everyone else.
That's okay.
Was the renovation part of the cause of the rusting, or was that just where at the point at which you discovered the problem?
Madam Chair, Representative, it was just at the point that it was discovered. The floors were renovated due to the changing occupant needs in the building. So it was kind of a sidebar to the work that was going on. The tuck pointing was done as part of those, and as part of that final renovation was discovered that the structural support system was rusting. So it was, they were clearly two different things, but discovered in the process.
Thank you.
Representative Freeman. Just a point of, Madam Chair, just a point of clarification. If this is a bonding issue, well, this wouldn't be coming out of...
Yes, it comes here first,
and then
it goes to capital investment.
Okay.
And part of the problem with this is I think the request has always in the past been made from the trunk highway bond funds, and everyone said they'd rather build roads than fix buildings, and so now I think this is the first time it's come as a general fund.
Yeah, between the transportation and the bonding thing, it threw me.
Yeah. Okay.
The second capital and bonding project that we have is a request of $2.2 million to purchase available property at 639 Jackson Street. I think in your packet you do have a map that is depicting where this piece of property is. But just a little bit of background, in 2006, the Central Park United Methodist Church notified us of the intent to sell their property at 639 Jackson. It turns out that the state of Minnesota has first right of refusal to purchase three of the parcels.
Is that the intersection of Jackson and University, or is it Jackson? We don't have a map of it.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Jackson and 14th.
Okay.
Yeah. The state of Minnesota has first right of refusal on three of the parcels that make up that property. It's kind of sandwiched between the state's 14th Street ramp and then the Stassen building property. Okay. And this would be an opportunity to purchase and acquire scarce capital complex land for immediate and future needs. We have a willing seller. The property is now tax exempt. It would meet immediate and critical need for visitor parking on the east side of the Capitol complex. And just as a side note, land available for development in and around the Capitol, as many of you know, is limited, and this bottom line would provide an opportunity to the state to maximize the state-owned infrastructure in the Capitol complex. If the state elects not to purchase this property, the property would likely be sold to another interested party. Regents Hospital currently leases space in the building, and they have expressed an interest in acquiring the property. So again, a request of $2.2 million to make this acquisition.
Okay. The math is going around. Any questions on this? Okay.
Anything else? That concludes our presentation, and we're happy to provide any other information as you need it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you for fitting into the allotted time perfectly. Yes. Okay. We did have a request from the National Association of Minority Contractors, and there is a... Did we pass out? There, in your packet, there is a fax document from them. I don't know if there's anyone here who wants to comment. Okay. Okay, the next presentation is something that I've been interested in, having the state take more interest. This is a person... this is an issue that deals with pension oversight issues. And this is the person that I've worked a long time with, ever since I got interested in the issue of pension oversight issues. And I think he has an interesting presentation that it's worthwhile for all of us to look about. We're not... What happens is that pension bills go to the Pension Commission, and then they go to government operations, and then if they're a funding bill, which usually they're divided to a funding and a non-funding bill, they also come to this division. But I've always felt it was appropriate that this division take an interest in the issue of pension fund oversight. I've actually wished that more parts of state government would take an interest in it. You do have a handout. The person who's going to make the information, who's going to make the presentation, will introduce himself. And he's going to have a PowerPoint presentation, and you do have a handout in your folder with the PowerPoint presentation. As soon as we get technically set up, we'll move.
Thank you. Chair, Representative. Thank you for having me talk with you today.
You must say who you are and also speak into the microphone as much as possible.
Probably discuss. Means I should slide over.
Well, probably okay.
My name is Mike Stolte, and I was asked to just present a quick review of the kinds of issues are present in the management of investment management processes. So with that, I will proceed rather quickly through the slides that you have handed out to you. Pension funds and endowments, foundations, other large institutional bodies of assets are typically controlled by a group of directors, and in this case, when you see the word directors, you can tell that this was originally and primarily developed for corporate pension fund use and application. And this is typically kind of, the way it works. For many, many decades, you've seen charts of this kind where stocks outperform bonds, outperform treasury bills, which bear no risk at all. So there's an obvious reward for taking risk and investing in more aggressive asset classes. These three don't at all represent the plethora of choices out there, because they can be subdivided and added to many ways. The boards, in looking at those choices and those asset classes, are required to form some sort of policy that helps them by looking at plan demographics and risk return trade-offs and such, helps them arrive at an appropriate mix of those asset classes. You don't find very many funds that are 100% in stocks, nor 100% in risk-free treasury bills. So some combination of these and many other choices come into the mix. The board, however, once it sets policy, usually delegates the implementation to experts who are at least expected to deliver the policy return and then some. Otherwise, their efforts are really not useful. We're going today to just roll all these delegated decisions about tactical deviations from policy and manager selection and all that, roll that effect into just one result for simplicity's sake here. That means that, in addition, I would say that there's a heavy reliance on outside experts and a relatively small amount on inside people. Now, large institutional funds have stronger inside staffs and can afford to use them rather than rely on outsiders to a great extent. But when you get out into the smaller funds, they almost always rely on outsiders. That exposes them to certain amounts of conflicts of interest and sales motivations. Don't need to elaborate on that, but you can imagine how much push and pull and pressure and salesmanship are applied in getting people hired and involved in the management of the assets. This is the 10-year period of time that we're going to look at today. And this was provoked by the Director's Monthly article that may be in your packet, because the Institute of Internal Auditors asked me to do a study that would give them some feel for how big a deal is this, how widespread or how expensive is the process if it is not fully rewarding, as in most cases it is not. So this period of time, you can see, was a period of 7 good years and 3 bad years. It ended in 2002, so it doesn't at all show the big recovery that came in recent years. But in this period of time, as bad as it was at the end, stocks still beat bonds, still beat bills. So the long-term relationship of those risk-reward trade-offs holds up. The mix of asset classes in an investment policy can be combined, or in some, you can call it a customized index can be created that represents the percentages involved in those choices made. And in this case, so we'll call that the policy index. That policy index can be accomplished passively by just investing in the very funds that are represent the asset classes selected. It isn't free. There's a cost to that, but it's very minimal at that level. Excuse me. Against this, again, against that policy potential can be measured the actual experience of the fund. And in this case, you can see that it tracked pretty well, that this fund identified as participant 11, because in all cases I promised not to use the names of the funds if they cooperated and provided the data. So just calling this one participant 11, and the gap there looks very modest. And so when people look at short-term periods and say, well, we might have earned 9.5%, but we got 9.1. Looks pretty close, not bad, next year might be better, and so the game plays on, if I may put it that way. This gap, however, while it looks pretty innocuous in terms of percentages, amounted to about $80 million. And the difference was less than 1% a year over that whole 10-year period. The compounding effect shows up, though, when the dollars are used in the calculation. Now, I'll just quickly go through these, and you will see that, for the most part, the cash flow was negative. That is, more money was paid out in benefits than was taken in contributions and other forms of contribution. No point in talking about the risk-free return, because it's always green. If the assets, visualize the assets off to the left of the chart, if they had all been invested in treasury bills, taking no risk whatever, this particular fund would have earned over $200 million. But wisely, the administrators took some risk and were involved in a mix of assets, including stocks, bonds, and other venture real estate investments. So the primary policy return represents the additional return over and above the risk-free return that was available to the fund through its investment policy. As we go through these slides, you will see that those first three bars can almost be ignored, because they all look very much alike. They're all green in the policy area over time. It's the right-hand bar that determines or that measures the value added or lost by those who are participating in the investment management process in that delegated area. The policy people are taken care of on the left side of the vertical line. On the right side, that one was negative. The next one was, here's a positive one, some slight negative ones. And I should mention that the data here, let me finish, though. I'll just go through the rest of these. You'll see some very small negatives and some large negatives. But only one clearly positive. Now, before I go further, let me say that it was very difficult to obtain the information that went into this study. In one case, a team of very interested retired police officers had to go into the fund offices and dig through piles of paper in order to get the information that they, too, were very interested in seeing analyzed. But my experience over the last 25 or so years of looking at funds of this kind is that the vast majority end up falling short of the policy potential, which means that they're giving back or leaving on the table some portion of the solid green bar that represents policy return. When the time period is expanded, however, and this, in this case, it reaches all the way back to 1982, and is, because this was part of a study that is public, this represents the Minneapolis Teachers Fund experience. Back in 92, Mark Dayton was state auditor and had this study done. At that time, the gap between the policy potential and the actual experience was around $160 million, a shortfall. That $160 million, and it doesn't matter if it was really $150 or $170 or whatever, it was a substantial shortfall. That money was never around during the long run of the 90s on the upside. So that shortfall compounded, and we had an increasing gap between policy potential and the actual experience of the fund. That gap then translated, if you'll let me combine the risk-free and the policy return and just call it policy return here, that policy return was diminished substantially by the investment management process. So even though more money was paid out in benefits than was collected in contributions, so the cash flow is negative, that's only part of the problem. The $1 billion underfunded liability was substantially increased by the effect of the, or the ineffectiveness of the delegated decision makers. Here's how that evolved, that $600 or $700 million shortfall evolved pretty steadily over time. And you could ask, how could this be? I know that there were double-digit positive rates of return earned by this fund along the way here. But it's almost impossible to catch up once you've fallen behind, because the shortfall is not available to enjoy the double-digit returns, and therefore the gap widens. And that makes it all the more important that the administrators of the funds know all along the way where value is getting away from them and where it is being captured. Back to that one fund that was clearly positive, and there were a couple of others that were so marginally close to zero that they could very well have been slightly positive too. But this one stood out and was, so it begs the question, well, how did that $30 million extra value added come about? How was it captured? So we can look at the evolution of that number. You see on the right-hand side, the end result is the $30 million, or 28, whatever it was. You see that for 7 years or so, it was a pretty ordinary experience. And then something wonderful happened. That was, to a great extent, held on to. If we want to zero in further, or more importantly, if the administrators of the fund want to zero in further and find out what did they do that benefited the fund so substantial, then we can look at the quarter-by-quarter value added or lost. And if you added all of those up from left to right, you would get to the $28 million positive outcome. Notice, though, that almost all of it occurred in one quarter of 1 year. So one quarter made the year, made the decade, actually. It leaves, though, the administrators in a place to ask, well, can we, or the board, maybe not the administrators, the board might ask, well, can we count on this kind of a recovery every year to take care of other periods when we come up red? Well, I do not know the exact explanation for that, but it's my understanding that they had chosen to invest a portion of the assets, probably a small portion, in a venture capital fund or private equity of some fund of some sort, and I believe it became an IPO and hashed out at some major multiple of the investment. So it wasn't necessarily the investment management process itself in the larger context, but a very wise or fortunate venture into an area that paid off nicely. And there's not a thing wrong with that. In fact, maybe more of that ought to be available to people, but when they're in very small funds, they don't get access to that kind of opportunity because the minimum investment is so high. This I'm just tossing in as something hearkening back to some research that's been done that claims that some 90% actually of the change in value of a fund is, I have to be careful here because this is a statistical reference, 90% of the volatility of the fund can be explained by the movements of the investment policy rather than the selection of securities and other smaller influences. But that 90-10 is, as I said, an explanation statistically based. If you really look at value added instead of rate of return information, it turns out that somewhere, and I'll use the number 80% or more, in this case maybe 90, but 80% or more of the institutional funds in the pension world, foundations, endowments, wherever, fall short of the policy potential, and therefore the board's policy offers more than 100% of what they actually end up with, and some negative portion, in this particular study it was about 10%, 10% of the potential is not captured. So it depends upon how you want to phrase it as to how you credit the policy versus the other decisions for the end value the fund achieved. This is back to, this is an actual fund that is not included in this study, but I bring it back here only, or bring it to you to let you know that these decisions can be further separated into their many other components. Deviations from policy and the skill of selecting money managers all can be separated, and you could, in a well-organized system, actually label those bars with people's names or the names of consultants or administrators. So we didn't go into this, but want you to know that with the data available, you can drill down in much deeper and find out where the leaks are. Also, by drilling down manager by manager rather than total fund, as was the case in this study, manager by manager, you can determine how much of the value added in this fund came from the investment policy provided by the board and the administrators, and how much was added by those they hired to improve on that return. In this particular case, and it's a real case, but not in the study, this money management firm collected a couple of $1 million for trying to add value, but in fact diminished the plan sponsor's impact by some $8 or so million in addition to the fee. So it is worthwhile to empower these administrators to hold the manager's feet to the fire and negotiate fees based more on delivery of the promises rather than just the promises themselves. This is cartoonish here now, but it's just meant to point out that a body of assets is going to grow over time, one way or the other. And the policy dominates this growth. The delegated decision area is like a leaky plumbing system that is letting assets sneak away and kind of run down the drain, so to speak. So by closing off those leaks, the end result may not be $196 million in this hypothetical case. Sorry. It may be 216 instead, or 220, or something more, just because the leaks are sealed off and more of the impact of the markets flows through to the end result. Fiduciary responsibility is a term that isn't very widely used. We have something like 700 pension funds, I believe, in the state of Minnesota, maybe second largest in the nation. And many of them are rather small, quite small, in fact. And I wonder how many of them actually would concede that they are fiduciaries and have produced certain responsibilities when they're dealing with other people's assets. There's a big distinction there between making bets with your own money and making bets with those belong to other people, especially retirement plan beneficiaries and participants. So there's a five-step process that's been very well laid out and described by the Foundation for Fiduciary Study in Pittsburgh. Don Throne heads it up. There are probably 600 to 700 of us who have gone through the program and are accredited as fiduciary auditors, which doesn't mean anything other than that we've become acutely aware of the process that's involved in getting assets from point A to point B. It would be wonderful if all of the plan administrators and some of the board members responsible for Minnesota's many pension funds could go through a program like that, but it's not economically feasible, although I would like to think that some gathering could be, some deal could be struck that would bring this kind of education to them. But if they then learn that there is a definite process, they can take steps one after one, two, three, and four, go through the process and become far more efficient and make the funds they're responsible for healthier and safer for those who are retiring in the future from those assets. The five steps are pretty simple. Basically, you need to analyze the position of the fund, know the plan demographics, how old are the people, how young are the people, what's the contribution flow, and so on. Make sure that they're looking at a diversified set of investment choices, not just certificates of deposit because it's safe or some other super risk-averse choice. Then formalize the mix of that set of diversified choices. Implement the policy efficiently, and that doesn't mean just hire anybody at whatever fee they demand, but be tough about that. Be efficient about it. There's always the passive alternative to fall back on if you're not capable or skilled at selecting money managers based on their apparent skills and based on their track records and so on. Too many times. How possible is it for an administrator to come to the board and say, I really think we ought to hire manager X? They've had a really poor performance the last 3 years. But it's that their part of the cycle is about to come around. Their positioning in the world of asset classes there is about to be rewarded. They're not going to get anywhere with that. It's far easier to sell a manager who's come in with 3 or 4 or 5 years of superior performance. Unfortunately, after they're hired, many times there's this reversion to the mean, and the fund experiences the pullback rather than enjoying a continuation of the history that was put in front of them. So it's a real challenge to select money managers at a time when they're poised to reward you rather than struggle. the weakest link in this process here, according to Fred Reich, one of the preeminent ERISA attorneys in the nation, is the failure to adequately and effectively monitor and supervise the process, the investment management process. So the idea here, the reason we're talking here, I believe, is to find ways to strengthen and support the administrators of these funds so that they can more effectively close the leaks and gain more value for the funds for which they're responsible. The information required is rather simple. There's an investment policy. It's probably in the minutes. Might not even change from year to year. There aren't that many changes made usually. Month-end asset values and cash flows. Think of this. You all have a checking account. Has a beginning balance every month. Deposits, withdrawals, and an ending balance. I'm sorry to tell you that that kind of information is unavailable if you go to many, many of Minnesota's smaller funds out there. And unfortunately, even some of the larger ones don't have a repository of that kind of data, as simple as it is. And with that information, they can have the charts and graphs and so on that will empower them to hold those responsible for the results they get. Now, drilling down deeper, looking at money managers and their particular benchmarks, the fees they generate, rates of return they generate, and so on, that extra set of information enables you to go further down and find out where more closely identify the leaks in the system, or the opposite, where the benefits are coming from, manager by manager. Point is, all of that information, everything we've talked about here, would fit on this CD. This does not take a warehouse of paper to accomplish this. This in the world of electronic transfers and so on, this kind of information should be readily available, and I would expect it actually to be available at the state auditor's office, where this information is normally reported. Unfortunately, there's still the challenge of processing it and keeping it in some form that can be readily accessed and used.
Okay.
That's just the last little slide here. There was kind of a joke behind this, but at a presentation I had to make in Austin last summer, we were looking at the mountain of assets that's exposed to the investment management processes in pension funds, 401ks, endowments, and all. And we had the table up there, and this particular set of assets just said 2.6. But the heading was trillions of dollars. And so, what's 2.6? Well, if you really lay it out there, it's a big number. And like an old congressman that I highly respected years ago, Everett Dirksen, long past, used to say, after a while, you're talking real money. So that's all I have to say at this point, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the very limited time left allows.
Sorry, I knew we wouldn't quite have enough time, but I thought this presentation would be useful before we deal with our first post-retirement issue on Thursday, the Duluth Fund. And anyway, any quick questions, Mr. Stolpe? And I will confess I've talked to Mike over all the years. I'm a big admirer of him in this process, so I'm not putting it out as, but, you know, I'm certainly willing to listen to any arguments or discuss, but I hope that this is something that we bear in mind when we're dealing with things like the State Board of Investment, when we're dealing with pension fund investment, when we're asking questions of the auditor about what kind of reporting systems we could have. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, I just want to, sorry, Mr. Stolte, I just want to clarify for myself what you're suggesting on sort of a policy basis is the implementation of a basically a software system of some kind of data collection system for just monitoring and comparing data, and not necessarily prescribing a certain way of doing it, but rather to have prescribe a way of reviewing information.
Madam Chair, the answer is a qualified yes. That is, I'm not sure what form that should take, but I believe that the data can be collected far more efficiently than it has been, and therefore made available not just for oversight at the state level, but made available to the administrators of these funds so they can get some feedback for the information they're providing. Instead of just answering, filling out forms and being and then listening to a consultant tell them whether they're doing well or not, they can find out for themselves if that information is in a form where they can access it and benefit from the analysis it makes available to them. I don't know that I answered your question fully, but if I didn't, please.
I've always kind of thought beyond the administrators that if the potential beneficiaries of the fund could, particularly for funds that are either defined contributions or benefits that depend on investment or the security of the fund that depends upon investment. And pointed out one of the first things that we've seen is that all Minnesota pension funds, I think, are two-thirds funded by investments as opposed to contributions. I think that ratio is about right. So the investment return for the funds to be solvent is twice as important as the contribution.
Yes, we discovered from some of this research that when the funds are underfunded, the first thing to look at for an explanation is we haven't put enough money in the fund. But as we could see in the case of Minneapolis Teachers as that example, a large portion of the shortfall was not due to not putting enough into the fund, but not capturing the full benefit of the of the policy return available. So it's not, there are two parts to this. How much do you put in the fund, and what do you do with the money that is in the fund, even if it isn't quite enough?
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives.
Okay. And meeting is adjourned.